Welcome to this episode of Season 5 of The Common Bridge, where policy and current events are discussed in a fiercely nonpartisan manner. The host, Richard Helpe, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and political analyst who has reached over 4 million listeners, viewers, and readers around the world. With our surging growth in audience and subscriptions, The Common Bridge continues to expand its reach. The show is available on the Substack website and the Substack app. Simply search for The Common Bridge. You can also find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The Common Bridge draws guests and audiences from across the political spectrum, and we invite you to become a free or paid subscriber on your favorite medium.
And welcome to episode 242 of The Common Bridge. My name is Brian Krueger, and I'm the producer of the show. This is the conclusion of a two-part interview with Beth Bourne, and we're going to back it up about a minute or so from last week's episode. I think you're going to find this very, very fascinating. And if you want to get caught up, go back to Substack or your podcast host of your choice and listen to episode 241, the first part of this podcast. The interview is really interesting. The conversation is incredible. And without any further ado, let's rejoin Rich Helpe and Beth Bourne on The Common Bridge.
Instead of saying, are you sure you want to do this, they're kind of upselling you.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Services. Now, if there's a short answer, what is body contouring? I don't even understand what that is.
You know, I actually, when she brought it up, I had not looked up the term. But what it is, it's just moving around, you know, how women tend to have more weight or fatty tissue on your hips or your muffin top or, you know, or on your thighs. To look more masculine, they would just take some of that, I guess that, you know, that extra fatty tissue, and maybe they could put it in your pecs or your calf muscles. This is part of the problem, though. Once you start these surgeries, and I heard from some patients at Kaiser, because I went on to some of these workshops, you know, they do multiple surgeries. They do the mastectomies, they do the hysterectomy, they, you know, might even do a phallus surgery or, you know, facial surgeries. For the men, it's really common to have their Adam's apple removed or shaved down. But, you know, you still, the problem is you still might feel like you don't pass for the opposite sex. And so, you know, if your hands are really small as a woman or your hips are wide or you're only 5'3", you're still not going to feel probably satisfied. So you're going to keep going in for more and more surgeries. And that's the part that they never brought up to me. They never brought up, hey, you're only 125 pounds. You're only 5'4", you know. We could give you a fake phallus, but you still might not pass because, you know, everything about me still looks like I'm a woman, no matter how short I cut my hair. Or
if you presented as someone that has gender dysphoria, if I'm understanding that, and they're now recommending hormone treatment and they're recommending surgeries, were you told this will cure your gender dysphoria?
You know, the term they like to use is we're here to help you reach your goals, you know, and they even said that we don't want to be seen as gatekeepers. You know, we want to help you become your authentic self. And they compliment you. They say, you know, this is so, you know, brave of you, or I'm not sure the word was brave, but, you know, it's very much of like praise for you to be here asking for these things and advocating for yourself.
And I'm going to come back to that gatekeeper. I've got some experience, and I'm not a clinical person, but I've worked for a lot of different hospitals, including Kaiser. And the notion of gatekeeper is that you want to have appropriate and effective care. The insurance companies, all the time, prior to a procedure and after the procedure, they want to know, was it appropriate for the diagnosis and did it work? Because their intention is, hey, we're not paying for it, right? And the physicians and other caregivers have the Hippocratic Oath to say, do no harm. So like an extreme example, if I went over to the University of Michigan this afternoon and said, I want you to cut my left arm off. They know how to do that, right? I'm sure there's a guy in there that knows how to do that. Oh, that's a gender neutral term, by the way, here in the Midwest, guy. I'm sure the doctor would say, we're not going to do that. That's going to harm you. And I can't imagine my insurance company saying, oh, yeah, we approve that procedure. But what you're telling me, Beth, is, and it's almost so bizarre to be true, that Kaiser said to you, hey, we don't want to stop you from doing this. We want to encourage this. But what was the malady they were curing? Did they say you were going to feel better mentally and physically after you've had this? And how long was the process before you were offered hormones and surgeries and the like?
Right. Well, you know, just to go back to that, and I strongly advise anybody who wants to learn more about this medical side of it, this will take you 5 minutes. Just go onto Kaiser's website and just ask, you know, Kaiser gender dysphoria, you know, what are the symptoms? How do you diagnose it? And how is it treated? You know, and I have the handout here in front of me. But, you know, the symptoms of being gender dysphoric is just that you're uncomfortable with a part of your body and it doesn't match your gender identity, that you're anxious or depressed, or that you're stressed. So the definition is something that, you know, by this definition, I've been gender dysphoric my entire life because I didn't like having big breasts when I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old and running around the track. You know, I didn't like the fact that, you know, whatever, the way my hips look. And most women are anxious and stressed. So everybody, I think, could fit the category of, you know, are you gender dysphoric? And then the way you diagnose it, it just says all you need to do is talk to your doctor and tell them that you feel upset about your gender identity. So that's it. That's how it's diagnosed, is you tell a doctor, you know, they kind of lay it out for you here, that you don't believe your body, you know, makes you feel comfortable with your gender. And then the way it's treated, you know, they just give the list of all the procedures and the drugs that they can do.
But isn't there something in there about mental health and, you know, emotional conditions? So there's been two studies where the correlation with autism and misdiagnosed gender dysmorphia, they are joined. That
right.
There's other mental and emotional.
Yes.
There had to be some screening. I mean, didn't they screen you for mental trauma or anything to say, well, wait a minute, let's make sure we know what we're dealing with here?
That's just it. And that's why I brought up the red flags. You know, I brought up the red flags of having an eating disorder. And these are all true. When I was in college and, you know, I was a distance runner in college, you know, anorexia and bulimia was, you know, rampant in my running club. And so I also had some eating disorders. And you know, I asked, could that be a red flag that, you know, I've always felt uncomfortable with the way I look and maybe that's why I want to change? And they said, no, don't worry. And then when I brought up that my mother had some mental illness in her 50s as well and had a body dysmorphia with, you know, she thought she had some like cancerous lymph nodes. Anyways, the doctors were not willing to operate on her. She got some, you know, wonderful mental health treatment. But when I brought that up to the Kaiser mental health, you know, and the mental health assessment, they tried to say, no, even though they did acknowledge that having a body dysmorphia in your family could be hereditary, they said, no, that's not the case with you, because in your mother's case, there wasn't really, you know, cancerous lymph nodes. But in your case, you just want your breasts removed. And we know, and they didn't say breasts, they said your chest tissue. We know you have chest tissue and we know you want it removed. So, you know, what you're doing is logical. And then the last issue I brought up was, that I had been sexually assaulted growing up, which, you know, a quarter of girls will have some kind of sexual assault when they're growing up. And in my case, I was, you know, grew up overseas in Mexico City. And so I was on the metro and the subways as a kid, and you get groped a lot by men. And that's a big issue. And anywhere where you have tight public transportation. So I brought that up. Is that maybe a reason that I'm uncomfortable, you know, in my woman body, is because I was sexually assaulted. And again, the Kaiser, you know, gender specialist said, no, that's not a concern. Well, just make sure, she said, you know, when you go to meet with the surgeon to have your top surgery done, we'll just be aware that you've, you know, been sexually assaulted. So that's how we're going to deal with it, is we're just going to put a note in your records. So there was nothing I could do to try to get them to give me what I would have seen as mental health services that I really needed, right? They never suggested, hey, why don't you first do some therapy? So they rushed it all. Within 4 months, I was given an appointment to actually have the surgery done. And all of the visits, you know, from my top surgery, my mastectomy, were all done online. It's all telemedicine. So, you know, when I met with the surgeon, she just had me, you know, lift up my shirt with no bra on so she could see how the surgery would go. And then she asked me, you know, where do you want the nipples placed after we remove the breast? Do you want to have them grafted back on, or we could use tattoos to put them back on?
So you never were in the same exam room with a physician. Nobody saw you in 3D. They're planning your surgery just like you and I are having this call today, three time zones away. And they're going to do an irreversible, life-changing surgery. I am astonished. I've had friends bankrupted or near bankrupted for tragic cases that they didn't choose. Breast cancer, ovarian cancer. Did they talk to you about what this was going to cost you?
Well, that's the other thing too. I learned during this conversation that these top surgeries have become so popular within the Sacramento area that they'd hired 4 new plastic surgeons. So this is my, you know, little area here in Sacramento, that there's this great demand that they're hiring new plastic surgeons to do these. And then I also learned that the reason why the plastic surgeons want to do these top surgeries is because when they're, you know, doing a procedure on a woman who's had breast cancer, they have to get out all of that cancerous tissue. So they have to be very careful. And then they also usually have to put in some kind of, you know, breast implant. But if you're somebody who's going in for top surgery, they can just fit you in their calendar, you know, with a cancellation, because they don't have to worry about, you know, really any breast, you know, cancerous tissue. They can just chop, and then you're not asking to have any kind of implants. So it's just, you know, stitching up. But also, Kaiser, you know, they were excited to tell me that it's only $100 copay for this surgery. So it's $100 because it's outpatient. And that means, you know, a procedure that's going to cost the Kaiser surgeon, you know, they're going to make $10,000-$15,000 off of it, is only costing me $100 because all of the other members of Kaiser are paying for it, right? So you have Kaiser is an insurer, but they're also the provider as an HMO. And then for the phalloplasty, they told me it was only $200 because, you know, it's 3 days of overnight stay at a hospital, but, you know, with my insurance, it would only be $200. And, you know, the phalloplasty for the surgeon, it's $100,000 is what it costs to do.
But I'm trying to think if that's male privilege, that it costs you $200 to have a penis added and only $100 to take your breasts off.
I wouldn't know
it would be the same. Well, what did they tell you about the phalloplasty? How were they going to do that? And how functional would this new penis look? And how functional would it be? And how would it look? What did they tell you about that?
Great. Oh, and real quickly, going back to the top surgery, you know, my good friend down in Southern California, she wanted breast reduction. She's my age and she'd had 3 kids and larger breasts. And she had to push so hard with her doctors to call it medically necessary. So she didn't have to pay the $10,000 to have just her breast reduced 2 sizes, you know, from an E to a C cup. But for me at Kaiser, all I had to do was say, this is, you know, I'm non-binary or transgender. And they just say immediately, well, it's medically necessary then. So, you know, that's another question, is why is it so hard to have your breast reduced in size when you have a bad back, you know, or you a real medical need versus, you know, this mental need where your brain doesn't match your body. Okay, so for the phalloplasty, And this was really shocking to me, was I was told I was going to need to be on the testosterone for 11 months. And I was wanted to push back and say, really, I have to be on testosterone for 11 months? I want to have my phalloplasty sooner than that. I want to have, you know, my top match my bottom. And Kaiser, they said, we'll talk with our specialist in San Francisco. That's where the surgeon is. And we'll see if they'll make an exception. And they did. So they gave me approval for a phalloplasty within 4 months. And I didn't really know much about what this surgery means. I learned a lot. So one of the first appointments, there's only two appointments for mental health. And the first appointment, they told me, you know, they asked me first, what are my goals for having this phalloplasty done? And I just said, you know, I want to, you know, have a penis and be able to stand, you know, when I go pee, or, you know, I gave some reasons why, you know, none of them make sense. And I wasn't worried about that. Right. Cause I'd already learned from the top surgery. I don't know what their incentive is to approve everything, but they do. I don't think there's anything you could say to not get approved for these surgeries. But, you know, this is the decision chart for having your phalloplasty done. I kind of wrote all over it, but it's like these three little circles that you choose from when you're making a decision about your lower surgery. And this is included in my article. This is one of the slides that Kaiser gave me. And so, you know, one of the big decisions you have to make is for this fake phallus is you need to get tissue from your body that they can transplant. So you need to choose between, you know, using this tissue on your wrist or using the tissue on your thigh. And then, you know, they explained to me that if you use the tissue on your wrist, the phallus is going to be longer and smaller and I guess diameter, because, you know, this skin on my arm has less fatty tissue. But if you use your thigh skin tissue, then it'll have more girth, or you'll have a wider, thicker penis. Anyways, so those are the decisions you have to make, as well as your phallus can either be allow you to pee standing up or to have penetrative sex. And, you know, none of this makes any sense, right? Because it's never going to be functioning. And so you're not really going to be able to use it as if you were a male person with a healthy penis. You know, if you look at, you can look online what these surgeries look like afterwards, and they're really disturbing. None of it makes any sense. I don't even call it plastic surgery, because it's not even trying to look like something that's real. So, it's all shocking to me.
Here's the thing. This sounds like a firsthand account. How can we be in this situation where we have the president of the United States, we have state legislatures, we have governors, we have well-funded and respected medical institutions all saying, we need to do this, we need to do more, because without it, we're not a good society. And they're quite firm about that we're not being inclusive, that we're being harmful to trans people. Were you ever told about success stories and like, look, we had a patient that was like you and we did these and that person's living much happier, healthier life? What did they tell you about that?
Yeah, so I will bring up some examples of how they try to, well, let me mention this first. Yeah. So what they do, what I see is with Kaiser is, you know, immediately they let you change your records on your health records. They let you change your name or pronouns. They give you all the attention of meeting with these, you know, different people you might want to meet with. And then they send you to these workshops. So for any surgery at Kaiser for gender affirming care, you can attend a Zoom call and you can hear the surgeon, you know, answer questions. And then they have a panel of recent patients who will talk about, you know, their experience and in very positive ways. And this is just a few months after these young women have had their breast surgeries. You know, I don't believe we do anything like this in any other kind of surgery. I've never heard of people going and listening to people talk about their knee replacements or their, you know, hip surgeries or some kind of like panel discussion where, you know, you're, to me, when I was listening to people talk about their experience having top surgery or their mastectomy, is that they were trying to tell you, you know, if I could do this, then you could do it. And here's what I did. You know, I made sure I had, you know, people help bring me meals or take care of my pets, or I, you know, changed my room around. And so this way, it's much harder to back out of, you know, your consideration of doing this because you're seeing these other people. And so.
Well, one thing I want to push back on a little bit, that it is common to have other patients talk, but like in the case of knee replacement, hip replacement, other surgeries, it's not necessarily recent patients because people really don't know. You might get your knee replaced, and how do you feel about it 3 years down the road, 8 years down the road, 12 years down the road? Big difference. When you get it first done, if you've ever been in pain, you're so relieved. You go, yeah, I think it's going to be better. So did they have any patients that had the surgeries done 5 years ago?
No, all very recent, all young people. The surgeon himself, he's actually a male who identifies as a trans woman. So to me, that was also, you know, it raised a red flag for me. Why do we have a patient who identifies as transgender being the surgeon who's doing these surgeries on young women who I don't think need to have their healthy breasts removed? So there's just a lot of concerns. And I saw that throughout Kaiser. There's a lot of doctors who are captured by this. Oh, and I want to add this is that, you know, I have friends here in this town who do work for Kaiser. And I know for a fact there's lots of physicians who don't want to be prescribing cross-sex hormones, right? So if you're an adult, you can go to your primary care physician and get a prescription to take, you know, in my case, testosterone, or in your case, you know, estrogen. Even though it's off-label use, you know, FDA has not said it's safe to do. But these Kaiser doctors, they don't want to be doing this. And so they've actually asked, you know, can you please give this, you know, request from a patient to another doctor? So they have a champion within, you know, Kaiser clinics, where you have one doctor who is the gender affirming specialist, you know, for adults to give out these, you know, wrong sex hormones. So I do think there's some really good doctors who don't want to be doing this. They don't want to be involved in it. They know it's wrong. But, you know, Kaiser has, I don't know what it's called, the golden handcuffs, where they pay their medical providers really well. And so a lot of doctors, I think, stay. And I do think a lot of the other Dignity Health or Sutter, the other big HMOs, they're also doing these kinds of gender treatments.
Beth, you've had an incredibly difficult journey with your child and, you know, the things that she's been exposed to, and potentially she has some big decisions coming up. I hope she'll hear your experience and hear that there are not the logical safeguards we do for, you know, everything in medical care. You know, simple hernia repair would take more disclosure, and it would take more pre-authorization than these radically changing procedures with no apparent positive medical outcome. And what you've experienced at Kaiser, I'd love to have somebody from Kaiser come on, or somebody from an opposing view, to explain to us what are we missing here. But you've had some issues in your community as well, that you're, you know, being quoted as a, quote, anti-trans activist. That's pretty harsh, you know, for an investigative journalist and a mother and a citizen. What's happened as far as the media coverage? And I understand, were you accused of planting bombs in a library or something like, you didn't, first of all, I should ask you, stipulate, do you have anything to do with planting bombs or making bomb threats to a library or anything?
No, I've nothing to do with that. And of course, any kind of threat of violence is a terrible idea, but, no, I have nothing to do with that. And so, I think they're trying to find some way to frame me in a way that doesn't make me look like just a rational, concerned parent. And so, we've seen these bomb threats all over the country. Anytime you have someone speaking out about something that's happening in the schools or the libraries, and then you get these threats, these bomb threats.
Has anyone ever produced the emails or recordings of voice calls with these bomb threats? Do we know that they're real?
You know, I did have one of the local journalists. He did send me a copy of the bomb threat email that he was sent. So I have seen them. You know, they said the FBI and the Yolo County Sheriff and our local police department were all investigating it. They never interviewed me. They never asked to see, you know, my computers. I don't think they actually thought I had anything to do with it. But you know, that's the problem. This has become a political issue where the left is saying it's kind and inclusive to give, you know, transgender kids whatever they want. And it's the right wing who's actually hateful and bigoted and transphobic for pushing back on this. And I keep trying to say, you know, I've been a Democrat my whole life. You know, I voted for Biden. How can you say that I am a right wing extremist? And why is it an extremist view to tell your child that, you know, for them to go on puberty blockers, they're going to be a guinea pig, right? This science has never been done before. You know, when I spoke to the endocrinologist here at Kaiser, they even said to me, it's an emerging field of science. You know, we don't have any long-term studies, but we'll put your daughter right away on puberty blockers or testosterone because we think it could be life-saving. You know, why is it life-saving to give a child a drug that's actually going to harm their body? You know, none of it makes sense. But they'll say to you, you know, would you rather have, you know, a living son or a dead daughter? So they put the parents in this hostage situation where you have to make the decision. If you don't give your kid these drugs, even though we can't prove that they're safe, you could risk losing your child to suicide. And it's all over the schools, this idea that you know, transitioning is life-saving, you know. So kids are even being introduced to this idea.
Let me break into that a little bit. So first of all, I went looking for any kind of study that said suicidal ideation is caused by, you know, belief in a transgender identity and is fixed by applying these chemical and surgical procedures. And there is none. There is no body of evidence that says we have studied this and yes, we think this reduces suicidal ideation. In fact, they said it's anecdotal and that we should not be taking extreme measures based on these anecdotes. And that's what Finland, Sweden, the UK, and the people that haven't been cowed into silence in the United States are starting to say, that it doesn't solve this suicidal ideation. The other thing is threats of suicide, all right, are made in lots of circumstances. A person tells their lover, if you leave me, I'm going to kill myself. That doesn't mean that that person needs to stay with them to prevent a suicide. It means that person that has a suicidal ideation needs to have help coping. And we've seemed to have lost our common sense with that phrasing. And again, I would be happy to look at any data, but it's not only not there, but it points to the opposite direction.
And it makes sense, right? If you've taken your body and you've harmed it in a way that, you know, if you take testosterone, you have vaginal atrophy, your bones and joints hurt, your brain's not working as well. You know, you've lost 5 to 10 years of your life. You know, a phalloplasty means you're never going to have, you know, a healthy sex life. If you have top surgery, you're never going to be able to breastfeed your baby. Of course, you're going to have more suicide ideation after these surgeries than before it. So, you know, the numbers are all right. They're just not the studies out there right now.
So you're in Northern California, right? So presumably you're not far from San Francisco. And as a liberal person and living in that part of the country, I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, that if a man wanted to, you know, dress in traditional female attire and that's the way they wanted to live their life, you'd probably shrug more power to them if they made that decision at 35 years old, something like to that degree. That wouldn't trouble you a bit, an adult making an adult decision.
You know, I probably would have said that a couple years ago, that it wouldn't bother me. But, you know, you really are not as in a safe situation if you see grown men, you know, using your bathrooms or, you know, even dressed in an appearance that looks like they're trying to not be, that you would not be as at risk of being harmed. But we know, you know, 99% of sexual assaults are done by men. And it's just normal for a woman to want to feel safe or for a child to want to feel safer because they see a female body. So some of it just does kind of bother me, you know, the idea that we're in situations where women or anybody wouldn't feel as safe because we're not seeing what's reality.
Well, passing down the street. Yeah. You're not going to judge somebody. If somebody's in a personal space, that's a little different issue.
Exactly. Yeah.
I would imagine Caitlyn Jenner doesn't bother you a bit.
I've heard Caitlyn Jenner likes to play golf as a woman. So, you know, even though they have said that they don't want to have boys or men in women's sports, I'm not sure if in their own golfing situation, if they always don't acknowledge that they have a great advantage in golf as a male body.
Caitlyn Jenner even says that transgendered people don't belong in women's sports.
Yeah.
And Jenner will not hit from the ladies' tees.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So that's good. I like that because, you know, male bodies are stronger, faster, you know, more spatial awareness, quicker reflexes. I mean, there's advantages in every sport from, you know, fishing to darts to pool to you name it.
That's why we have women's sports, women have come a long way in basketball, women's softball, swimming. And it's very difficult to compete with a male. And we, of course, have the Leah Thomas, which I understand has not gone all the way, that likes to show his male genitalia in the locker rooms is mine. Again, I'm not an expert on this. I'm just the interviewer, but let's come back to what's the media coverage been like? I mean, I would think if I was in, you know, Davis, California or Sacramento, and I had this story on the local news, and I'm a, you know, dues paying member of Kaiser, I'd kind of like to want to know about this. Have you gotten much coverage on local print or electronic media?
You know, I did notice just last week our local newspaper they had an event where they brought in this national speaker to speak out against Moms for Liberty. And so they mentioned me being, you know, the chair of Moms for Liberty and that I had done I'm not sure what the word was they used, but basically they were trying to say that I had done something wrong by trying to figure out what would happen to my child when they turn 18. So the article was written in a very negative way of me doing this undercover work. I would hope mainstream media would pick it up more, but I can see why they wouldn't. I mean, if you open a newspaper or a magazine or go on a website, some of the biggest ads all come from these medical providers and these drug companies, right? So if you open up my local paper, you're going to see a big ad for Kaiser. You're going to see a big ad for, you know, Dignity Health. Why would a newspaper want to, or a news station want to cover the story of a woman who's saying that our medical establishment or, you know, Kaiser has been captured by a dangerous, you know, ideology? So I'm not surprised that the local or the, you know, the mainstream media is not picking it up. But some other much bigger, larger international news outlets are hopefully picking up the story soon. So I've been talking to reporters who will be picking up the story.
Well, you've had quite the journey as a mother and as a investigative journalist, and now as a target, if you will, of a backlash. And it sounds to me like you're trying to get facts out there and your perspective. And of course, there's always more facts to come as a story's unfolded and there's other perspectives. And again, we invite anybody that has a countervailing view, we'd love to have you on the program and to express your support. And if we've gotten something wrong here, we'd sure like to be corrected about it. So we invite that. Beth, as we come to the close of our talk today, is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to make the readers, the listeners, and the viewers of the Common Bridge aware of, or any kind of closing remarks? This has really been a powerful talk today.
No, I've just enjoyed all your questions. They've been excellent. I think what I maybe the wisdom I would like to pass on to any, you know, parents or aunts and uncles or grandparents who are listening is to just be really curious about what it is your kids are learning from elementary school through high school, college. If you could just ask them some questions about, you know, what do you think about being a man or a woman, or you know, ask them if you could see their science book, if you could look at what they're learning in their health class, and you know, maybe even meet with a teacher, but to really drill down deep into finding out how what they're learning about, you know, human bodies. And then, you know, what does that mean as far as, you know, could you change your human body? And then what is being offered to kids, you know, whatever your insurance is, just ask that question to your, you know, your child's pediatrician is what would you do if you heard from my child that they want to change their sex? Because a lot of those conversations are happening now while the parents are asked to leave the doctor's office. You know, once a child is 12 years old here in California, they can meet in private with their doctor. And once they're 14, you know, parents don't even have access to their emails back and forth. So just be really curious. And just appreciate getting to be on your show today. It's wonderful.
Beth, thank you so much. We've been talking today with Beth Bourne about a very delicate, very complicated topic around transgenderism, transgender rights, transgender ideology, and the impact on youth and the medicalization. Look up Moms for Liberty. Look up Colin Wright. Look up Beth Bourne, and satisfy yourself with your own education. We try to do our part to inform here on the Common Bridge. And with that, this is your host, Rich Helpe, signing off on the Common Bridge.
Thanks for joining us on the Common Bridge. Subscribe to the Common Bridge on Substack.com or use their Substack app, where you can find more interviews, columns, videos, and nonpartisan discussions of the day. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can also find The Common Bridge on Mission Control Radio or your Radio Garden app.